There are no ethical sentences that drop direct from heaven into our world. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not covet. Those are sentences that are born of God's contact with the world. They are the word of God, and they are also the words of men. And they are not pure word of God dropped from some other kind of world. Ethics is a matter of history. It's a matter of the earth, as also is theology. So Barcelona was a time for the development of his ideas and the development of his theology. He preached a good deal. His sermons, some of his sermons are preserved and printed. He took another trip to Rome from Barcelona, and he took another trip to North Africa with his brother Klaus. He was there for a year, came back to the University of Berlin. Then he had to write a dissertation, a final term paper for his theological degree, and he wrote a book entitled Act and Being. Now, I think that's a remarkable title, although the book is a bit pedantic, and it's certainly mature, and unless you've read a lot of Bonhoeffer and decided to be a Bonhoeffer nut, I wouldn't advise that you start with that book. I think it's very difficult reading, and I still have a hard time with it, but the basic idea is very, very clear. He is trying to say that action is one way of interpreting reality, that what is true and what is real is that which is moving. Long, long years ago in ancient Greece, Heraclitus said, "You can never step into the same river twice." All of history, all of movement, the glaciers, the stones, the rocks, people, politics, everything is in process. Everything is changing. Everything is movement. Everything is action. God is action. God is moving. Well, that's one whole stream of thought through the whole history of mankind. That which is real is that which is moving, in process, acting. There's another whole stream of thought that says that which is real is that which is permanent. That which is. The isness of a thing is that which is real. Being is more real than act. Now there are big words for that, and there are lots of people representing all those positions and so on. Bonhoeffer was, in a certain sense, a kind of a mediating thinker and theologian, although in another sense he was a very radically diastatic thinker. But because he was radically diastatic, or, yes, thank you, you can contrast the word diastasis with the word synthesis. Synthesis means to put together. Diastasis means to take apart. Synthesis means to talk about how things are alike. Diastasis means to talk about how things are different. So synthesis in theology is a way of showing how Christianity is like other religions. Diastasis in theology is to show how Christianity is unlike other religions. So Bonhoeffer was essentially a diastatic theologian, because he says Christianity is not like other religions. Christianity is non-religious. But the very fact that he was that kind of a person led him into this non-two-sphere thinking, which insisted no God without world, no world without God, which then required him to put everything together. But he put everything together because of a radical commitment to the particularity, the diastatic specificity the under Pontius Pilate nest of the Christian faith.
Did that make Jesus get that? All right. The there are people who say what's important about Christianity is that which is generally true in all religions. Nuts to the manger, nuts to Gethsemane, phooey on Pontius Pilate, who cares about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? The big deal about Christianity is love your neighbor, or God is good, and we thank him for our food. Huh? That's what you can, you know, you can forget about all the little specifics and all the little peculiarities. What's big about Christianity is the generality. Huh? Now that's a synthesis kind of position. You might think, or a person might think, that that kind of position leads one to embrace the world, huh? Because that allows you to say to your Hindu brother, I'm saying the same thing, a little different words, problem of semantics, but we're really on the same wavelength, see? So it allows you to embrace the world. Actually, I think, and Bonhoeffer thinks, it's the opposite. When you start dealing with Christianity as a generality, you always fall into religion, and you start to say that the really real are these general abstract truths, and the nitty-gritty historical realities are of no more significance than the nitty-gritty specific realities of the time of the people of Israel and the time of the incarnation of Jesus Christ. So you wind up thinking that you're going to gain the world, and you wind up losing it. Now, Bonhoeffer says, no, you don't begin that way. You don't begin by saying, what's great about Christianity is the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man, and nuts to the specificities. Bonhoeffer says, what is significant about Christianity is not the generalities, but the specificities. What's important about Christianity is that there was this guy, Abraham, and he lived in Ur of the Chaldees, and he said this, and he did this, and then there was this guy, Isaac, and he had a son by the name of Jacob. And there were 12 sons. See. And then there was Pontius Pilate, and Jesus came. He was a carpenter, and he did this, and he did that. People said this about him, and he said this about himself. He was crucified under Pontius Pilate. He was born when Quirinius was governor of Syria. Those guys get into the Christian confession because, as Dorothy Sayers says, there have been incarnate gods aplenty and slain and resurrected gods not a few, but he is the only God who has a date in history. He happened. Huh? He's not an idea. He happened. That's the big thing about Christianity. So that the Christian faith is nothing if it loses its moorings in the historical specificities, particularities, the diastatic realities of the faith. Now, one might think that kind of commitment to those kinds of specificities would make one narrow in his outlook, would make one think only about, Bible, and only about hymns, and only about being with Christian people or something like this. As a matter of fact, it's the opposite. See? It's Barth who says Bible in one hand and newspaper in the other hand. It's Bonhoeffer, not these liberal birds who all, almost to a man, supported Adolf Hitler.
As Bonhoeffer, who was concerned about those terribly specific articles of the Christian confession, who was able to say, because God is not in the sky in some general abstract fatherhood of God and brotherhood of man, because he was in that particular place when Quirinius was governor of Syria under Pontius Pilate, that means that he is also in our specific place and in our specific time, and I can embrace this world because God so embraced the world that the Word became flesh at that time and that place, and the Word becomes flesh at this time and at this place. So that you begin with that diastatic, particularistic, specific commitment, huh? To the creedal affirmations, and you wind up, and the whole world is yours. That's what Paul says in 1 Corinthians, huh? For all things are yours. And you could read, because you are Christ, and Christ is God. So that's what I was trying to say when I said that that's a little bit peculiar, in a way that he is an extremely diastatic, particularistic, specific, let's drop that one. He's gung-ho for Pontius Pilate. and it's precisely that kind of commitment that leads him into a posture of being a kind of mediating theology where he, because the whole world is God, he has to somehow or another put it all together. Huh? And so he writes this book, Act and Being, two major streams of thought, two major ways of reading the world, very, very different from one another. And Bonhoeffer says, if you know who Jesus Christ is, then you don't reject being for the sake of act, and you don't reject act for the sake of being. One illustration, for instance. If you're a being man, then the big thing is, let's say about Jesus Christ, the big thing is, who is Jesus? If you're an act man, then the big question is, what does Jesus do? If you're a being man, the big question is, what is God? We have to describe God's kind of permanence. He is omnipotent, omnipresent. You define God. If you're an act man, you say, what does God do? He saves his people, redeems Israel, leads us out of Egypt, raises Jesus from the dead. Those are massively different kinds of ways of reading the world and ways of reading the faith. Bonhoeffer says, if you understand who Jesus Christ is, you cannot reject one or the other of those. But he does come out on the side of act. That's where his emphasis is. And he says that the church has too often begun with being and moved to act, and he suggests beginning with act and moving to being. That is, some of you may know the phrase, the person and work of Christ. That's the phrase that has been used for centuries in theological study, the person and work of Christ. Bonhoeffer would say, it ought to be the work and person of Christ. You don't first say who he is and then what he does, but you say first what he does, and then you say who he is. That is, his being is a function of his action, and the same is true for God. The big thing about God is not that he is, the big thing about God is that he does. Huh? He is what he does, more than he does what he is. Does that make any sense? Is that confusing?
Huh? I'm starting to have a little trouble.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that the same as form and function?
Yeah. You can do it that way. And Bonhoeffer would...
Are you suggesting then that the form follows the function?
Yeah, precisely. He's a Frank Lloyd Wright man. Right. Theological form, sentences, follow function. Sentences ought to be carved out in the context of that thing that those sentences are meant to accomplish, right? Because Jesus is, first of all, an actor, a doer. God is, first of all, an actor or a doer.
The contrary. He became.
The incarnation.
That's becoming.
Yeah, but becoming is, that's movement.
Being.
Becoming, well, you can say becoming and being. Being and becoming. Becoming is action. Let me, can I take a brief parenthesis?
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you.
No, that's all right. You go through the some theological library and look up all the classic dogmatic texts, or get a hold of some maybe even some contemporary adult class instruction things, and you turn to the section on God, and I'll just bet you 9 out of 10 begin with a chapter on what is God, and then you'll say, well, now God is a spirit, God is a being, God is omni, all present, all powerful, all that. First you define God, and then later on it gets to what God does. See, a Bonhoeffer would say, I would say, to begin the other way. Who is God? God is the God who created. God is the God who brought his into being a people. God is the one who called Abraham. God did this, he did this, he did this, he did this. Now, when I talk about and think about a God who's done these things, then I might ask the question, what can I say about his isness? See? But his isness is a function of his action rather than the other way around. That's a matter of emphasis, you know, a matter of where you're going to put your marbles. But Bonhoeffer would absolutely refuse to separate those, but he does put the emphasis on act rather than being.
Could that be a matter of our recognizing the fact that we don't know God's being except in recognizing his act?
Yeah. What if you begin with being, then you're back in that conscience business, or you're back in that rational business.
Yeah.
I know the being of God because somehow my mind is like his mind or something.
Yeah.
There's a long tradition of that.
Yeah.
Bonhoeffer would say, no, you know God because there have been people who have been led to bear witness to his activities in the history of his people, in Jesus Christ, in the resurrection, death and resurrection, in the pouring out of the Spirit, and so on.
Yeah.
You begin with the event.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Let me, can we go here?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry. It's been covered much better than my question.
No. can we come back to it, Willie? Yeah. The, that's the first book that he wrote, Act and Being. He had a beast of a time publishing it, and sent around all kinds of publishers. Nobody wanted to publish it, and finally he paid out of his own pocket to have it published, and it died. I mean, it just came out of the printing press and just right down there. And they still have, you know, these piles of them wrapped up back in the back room. And nobody read that thing until years later, after his death, after through books like Life Together, Cost of Discipleship, after the letters and papers were written, then people said, hey, we better find out something about this guy, and started to go back and read that book. He says a lot about conscience in Act and Being. Very beautiful things about conscience, in which he says conscience, this is against Carl Hall, his teacher, conscience is not a legitimate signal from God or a legitimate tube by which I can know what God is telling me to do. Conscience, and Luther said the same thing, is a sign of my dividedness. It's a sign of the fall. That's what conscience is. The fact that I have a conscience that nags me tells me that I am a sinner, that I am a son of Adam, that I have to live in the forgiveness of sins. I think that that whole business about conscience is terribly, terribly relevant, because we are, I think, in the church and culturally on a new conscience kick. There are all kinds of people who have all of religion and all of God and Bible and Christianity funneled down into conscience. And anything that a person does conscientiously is just beautiful. Bonhoeffer says, don't kid yourself. It's not as though, you know, I'm a sinner, but then there's one little sparkling jewel here that never got touched, and that's the conscience. The conscience is also perverted, distorted, and is a terribly unreliable guide, even the enlightened conscience, to Christian behavior. Okay. Then, after Act and Being, which was his first thesis, he wanted to get a teaching job. This is why Bake has the first chapter entitled Theologian. He didn't really think so much in terms of being a parish pastor. He thought in terms of making it in another field, as his big brothers had made it in law and science. He was going to be their equal in theology, and so he wanted to be theologian. It was a perverted early notion of his. And so he wrote a second dissertation, which was his Habilitationsschrift, which was a kind of a dissertation on the basis of which he might get an appointment to teach at the university. And the title of that thing is Communio Sanctorum, or the Communion of Saints. I have made a mistake. I've made many mistakes. I have made a specific mistake now. The first book was The Communion of Saints. The second book was Act and Being. Okay? They're written very closely when he's about 21 years of age, but he wrote Communion of Saints first, Act and Being second. They're very similar in that they grow out of a basically Barthian, diastatic, if we can use that word now, commitment, but they are both kind of attempts to embrace the whole world and put it all together. And whereas Act and Being was an attempt to put that action thing and that being thing together, Communion of Saints was a book that was his first book, was an attempt to talk about the church as a divine community and a human community at the same time. Now, all of us would say that. The church is made up of a bunch of slobs like us who all have our problems, and we're sinners, and we're just a pretty motley crew, but at the same time, we are the body of Christ, and our greatness does not lie in our great moral behavior, but our greatness lies in the fact that we have been declared to be, and we are, members of his body. So we would all say that. But what Bonhoeffer does is to work it out on the basis of the revelational theology of Karl Barth and the sociological work of Ernst Troeltsch. Troeltsch was one of those people at the University of Berlin who said that the church is essentially a sociological community. Well, there'd be a tendency to say, it is not. It's, you know, the body of Christ, God, divine community. Don't try to apply all of those sociological tools to us. Bonhoeffer would say, of course that's a human community. It's the church is a community just as subject to historical forces, sociological forces. It is just as much the object of sociological research and study and analysis as any other group of people. That's an absolutely legitimate enterprise. But, It is also, at the same time, the body of Jesus Christ. It is a community of God's revelation. And so, like the incarnation, the Word became flesh, and like God and world together in Jesus Christ, so the church can be properly understood not only as a divine community or only as a sociological community, but only when those two are seen not kind of loosely connected, but together. And he attempts in that book to do a sociological-theological study of the church. Now, that book, too, is difficult reading, and it never made any big splash. Very few people read it. Karl Barth finally read it after Bonhoeffer died, and he writes into his Church Dogmatics that this book is a theological miracle. And that may have been because Barth thought it was really a great book. It may have been because it comes out very pro-Barth, but he does say that, and there are, of course, a lot of people now who are interested in finding out what Bonhoeffer said at that early time. This is why I say that I disagree with those people who say that Bonhoeffer finally comes to the end of his life and says a lot of wild things in the letters and papers from prison, like non-religious Christianity and so on. It seems to me that an act in being in the community of saints, in his time in Barcelona, and all of his life, I mean, there was an amazing integrity and continuity. It's essentially the same kind of thing. Okay, he writes those two books. Then he gets, on the basis of that, the possibility of being a Privatdozent at the University of Berlin. That's a kind of a volunteer, junior assistant, paper grader, and occasional lecturer at the university. Before he starts teaching, he gets a fellowship to spend 1 year at Union Seminary in New York. And so he does that. And on the way to New York, he is in the boat, and he writes to his grandmother, "I haven't figured out yet who my traveling companion is. I've been trying to figure it out because he has a walking stick. He has his raincoat. He left this book, so-and-so." He figures out he must be an American student. He turns out to be a Dr. Lucas, who is principal of a school in Lahore, which was in India, which is now, I think, in West Pakistan. And Bonhoeffer discusses then with his travel mate the possibility of going to India. At a very, very early age, Bonhoeffer has an interest in India. He has an interest in Gandhi. He has an interest in nonviolence. He has an interest in Eastern religions, not because they're the same as Christianity, but because he knows that the whole world belongs to God, and somehow or another, God in Jesus Christ has not abandoned that place in the world. So he has that kind of passionate concern. He talks with this guy on the way over, and he's never able to pull it off, but he does make that attempt. He arrives in New York, and he becomes almost immediately the spokesman for Barthian theology. Union Seminary at that time had been the bastion of American social gospel theology, as Berlin was the bastion of German liberalism. They had a great deal to do with one another, but slightly different.
And under Fosdick,
right. Fosdick was there, and Lieper, and guys like Van Dusen were just beginning. John Niebuhr. Bennett, and Reinhold Niebuhr was there. So he had just come, and Reinhold Niebuhr was the kind of Barthian voice on that social gospel faculty. So it's not strange that the guy on that faculty that Bonhoeffer should latch on to is Reinhold Niebuhr, of course. And Niebuhr is a person who, like Barth, went to Detroit, started to preach, and thought, "My goodness, this is actually just garbage that I'm pouring out here." He went back to the scriptures, back to the Reformation, and started talking about justification and forgiveness and all those kinds of things. Without, however, losing the social gospel. Barth never lost the influence of liberalism, neither did Bonhoeffer, and Niebuhr never lost the influence of the social gospel, but what is a chastened social gospel movement in Niebuhr. Okay, he came into many kinds of influences. He made immediate friends with a guy by the name of Frank Fisher. He was a black student at Union, and he spent a lot of time in Harlem. In fact, Bateke says that he went into Harlem every Sunday and worshiped in an Abyssinian Baptist church in Harlem. Okay, he came into many kinds of influences. He made immediate friends with a guy by the name of Frank Fisher. He was a black student at Union, and he spent a lot of time in Harlem. In fact, Bateke says that he went into Harlem every Sunday and worshiped in an Abyssinian Baptist church in Harlem with Frank Fisher, and he volunteered and taught Sunday school in that Abyssinian Baptist church in Harlem. He spent a lot of time with Frank Fisher, and he wrote, and this is in the collected work, he wrote about the black problem in the United States, and he said, this thing has got to blow. It can't go on very much longer. He miscalculated the time. He thought it would blow a lot sooner than it has. But here's this young kid who comes to study theology in New York. He makes friends with a black. He spends time in Harlem. And he just has got ears and eyes and nostrils to pick up the smells and the sights and the sounds of this situation. And he says, America cannot live complacently with this situation very much longer. The year is about 28. Yeah. He also came into contact with American pragmatism. He read a lot of John Dewey. That is a whole philosophical stream that the Germans knew nothing about. And pragmatism is a whole big bag, of course, and a lot of you may know much more about that than I. But essentially, Dewey was concerned with learning by doing. That's one of the great cliches of pragmatism. He was one who said you cannot have academics without practicum. You cannot learn anything without practicing it, without doing it. In a way, that's kind of putting those two spheres together again. And he read a lot of William James, who was also on that same line. He read Whitehead, process theologian, who is very big at the present time, and whose big thing, Whitehead was a British mathematician who came to Harvard University and developed a whole philosophical system called process theology. And process theology says lots of things, but one thing it says, talks about Charles Hartshorne. These are names that some of you may be interested in and some not, but the substance, I hope, is significant. Hartshorne talked about the dipolarity of God. There are two poles that one must always keep in mind when he talks about God. One is the fact of his constancy, his continuity, and the other is the fact of his change. God is both being and act. There is a certain congeniality between Bonhoeffer's theology and process thought. He did an amazing amount of speaking at YMCAs and ladies' groups and all kinds of stuff. Baker has a little church notice from a Baptist church in there that says, come in here, Professor Bonhoeffer. He isn't a professor, and they spelled it B-O-N-H-O-I-E-E-F. You know, come in here, Professor Bonhoeffer. Say how it really is in Germany. Don't miss it. Coffee and donuts for everybody. So he was just wheeling and dealing and tooling around there at the same time that he was wowing them in the seminars. He was an amazingly intelligent person who somehow or another was able to get along without very much sleep, and apparently gave the impression to everybody that he spent all of his time playing tennis and hunting down foreign restaurants in New York and London and going to the ballet and the opera. And somehow or another, he got this incredible amount of stuff read and thought and done. And he did that also when he was at Union Seminary. I mentioned yesterday he went down to Cuba at Christmas time and preached in a German congregation down there, picked up some signals about the situation there. Afterwards, he and his friend Jean Lasserre, the French friend of his, who was a pacifist, and Lasserre has a book, I think it's called War and the Gospel, that's in English, and Bonhoeffer was very much influenced by Lasserre. He never became a pacifist himself, but he's very attracted to pacifism. It worried him a lot. Jean Lasserre and Bonhoeffer borrowed an old Oldsmobile and went out to the West Coast. They didn't make Holden, but they skirted, you know, the area here. And down 101 into Mexico, and the car exploded or died or something down there, and they took a train back. They covered 4,000 miles in that car, and another couple thousand on train, and back to New York and back to Germany. I guess the point of all that is that he was an incredibly open and sensitive guy to everything that was going on. He was like a sponge, and everywhere he went, he just soaked up everything. At the same time, that he was doing this incredible amount of purely, in quotes, academic work. So he was, in his own life, I think, a model of the kinds of things that he talked about. He goes back to Berlin, and he starts to teach then at the University of Berlin as a Privatdozent. This was 1931, I think, and it was a big religious boom. It was a theological boom. There were 1,000 theological students at the University of Berlin at that time. Hitler was just beginning to gain some force and power, just beginning to come into prominence. And Bethke says that 90% of the theological students at the University of Berlin were pro-Nazi at that time that he began to teach. He gave some lectures on Christology that first year, and students took down notes, and those notes were compiled, put together from about 4 different guys, both Peter Timmermann and a few others, took their notes and collated them and put them together, and those notes are published in the collected works. Some guy, I think it was Edwin Robinson, came along to the collected works, took those out, translated them, and put them into hardback under the title Christ the Center. And those are his Christology lectures at the University of Berlin, given only one time, taken down in student's note. It's not really a book, but it is a compilation of student notes on Christology. He also gave some lectures on Genesis 1 through 3, and that book is entitled Creation and Fall, and that was published almost immediately. And that was the first book that he published that anybody read, and that was received rather well. I read that thing for the first time and really did not like it very much because I couldn't figure out what in the world he was talking about. It was an exposition of Genesis 1 through 3, and there are no footnotes in there, and there are no references to von Rath or Eichrot or to Kittel's Hebrew text. And I said, what in the world is going on here? And I threw up my hands, and that thing sat then for a couple of years. And when my wife went to the hospital to give birth to our third child, it was in Albany, Oregon down here, the whole business went rather rapidly, and as she was going out the door, she grabbed a couple of books, one of which was Creation and Fall, and when I came to see her after Debbie had joined us, my wife was on the ceiling, just flying around up there, and I said, come on, down, and she had Creation and Fall in her hand, and she's been reading this book, and,
it wasn't book for you.
Yeah, no. Creation and Fall, although it does have something to do with procreation, right, and, she understood that because she didn't read it with a microscope as I had read it, and it says that word for image. Now there are 2 words for image, and which one is he talking about? And how does, you know? I was trying to get a focus on that, and it wouldn't focus. And my wife didn't worry about that. She's just reading this thing, and you know, it completely blew her mind. And then I learned from her that what Bonhoeffer had done with Genesis 1 through 3 was to write an exposition that was congenial to the text, which is itself poetry. Huh? And you take a poetic text, and Bonhoeffer wrote a poetic, rhapsodic exposition of that text, which is an appropriate thing to do. And I had thought that what you really have to do is to write a microscopic analysis of every silent schwa and semicolon there, and you can't do that with Genesis 1 through 3, or you miss it. So if you should read Creation and Fall, you have to remember that that's poetry, not only in the text, but in Bonhoeffer's exposition of the text. And then you'll fly too, see? But you'll never fly if you try to read that with a microscope. And that's one of the beautiful things about this guy too, that he is so diverse in his talents and in his interests. He can do the microscope thing. And when he does it very, very well. But he can also be rhapsodic. Huh? So he writes. He gives the Christology lectures, and he writes Creation and Fall. Here she comes. I knew she wasn't here. I would have never told you about it had she been here. So you came in just as a. Or did you walk out when you heard me start talking about you? No. Anyway. During this time, I mentioned this yesterday, he is teaching at the university. He also does a lot of ecumenical work. And that is not just coincidental either, because in the church of which he was a part, ecumenicity was a bad thing. Generally, people wanted to be not international Christians, but German Christians. And to go to these various ecumenical meetings was to say something about the body of Jesus Christ being a universal phenomenon and not just a German phenomenon. So he did a lot of traveling, a lot of work, a lot of speech writing in the ecumenical movement. He also took on a job as chaplain to students at this technical university in Charlottenburg, and he was not a very big success there. I think that they wanted hay rides and wiener roast, and he somehow or another didn't make it very well, but he did serve there. Then he found out about a confirmation class in Wedding, which is the biggest slum that Berlin has and had at that time. There were 50 kids that were driving a pastor out of his gourd, and he was just completely unable to handle them, and as a matter of fact, he died a few weeks after Bonhoeffer came, and Bonhoeffer wrote to his friend that this guy was literally hassled to death. When he arrived at Wedding to take over this class, the pastor met him at the door and led him up some steps, and the kids were sitting on the banister and sliding on the banister and throwing stuff at these two guys walking up to the third floor where they were supposed to teach this confirmation class. I don't know what they were throwing, but they were, you know, erasers, banana peels, and hollering and shouting. So he brought them to the room. He said, "This is it," and the senior pastor said, "So long," and went down. Bonhoeffer walked into the room and simply put his hands in his pockets and leaned against the wall and didn't say a thing. And gradually, I'm not sure this is an educational technique that would always work, but it did work with him, maybe simply because of some kind of charisma that he had. The kids quieted down. He told them a story about Harlem, and he said, "See you next Wednesday." And according to the story, that may have been embellished, you know, over the years, but according to the story, he never had any more trouble with those kids, and in fact, he had them over to his house. That was a little bit too far to go. He moved out of his parents' plush place in the suburbs into a walk-up apartment in Wedding, and taught, you know, at the university out of that apartment, and spent every night with these kids telling stories and eating popcorn up there. He kept in touch with these kids after they were confirmed, and they wrote to him, and he wrote to them, and I just simply can't imagine that, you know, but that's what he did during his first year of teaching. So he was a very, very busy guy. Okay, now a word about, I don't know whether I'm talking you absolutely to death or not. I'm sure that, you know, this can't go on forever. I don't know. Huh? Pardon me? Well, I think that we ought to, you know, we'll stop it before too terribly long, or we can talk or something or other.
Let
me.
Well, is that what that was for?
Yeah.
Uh
oh.
What do you mean?
No. He. The question is, was he married?
You wondered, oh, you got all these things down.
Yeah. He was engaged, however, twice. And
Kierkegaard didn't make it, huh?
Yeah. Well, he was engaged to one girl, and in 1935, that engagement was broken. And I have never been able to squeeze out of any of the Bonhoeffer people the name of that girl. She is now married to a German theologian, a very prominent German theologian, and chooses to have that little segment of her life anonymous. And so I don't know who that was, but he was engaged to her, and they broke that engagement because he decided that the times were such, it was 1935, there was obvious it was going to be a time of tremendous tragedy and turmoil, and it was almost like Paul in 1 Corinthians 7. There was a time when he thought he would be better able to serve unmarried. That was a very painful experience for him. And Eberhard Baitke, his biographer, somebody stole my book. Okay. Baitke happened to have a broken engagement at the same time. And when they met at Finkenwalde, both in this aftermath of broken engagement, that, among other things, brought them close together. That was the first, right. That was the first, literally. That was the first, he said, crying in the beer. That was the first engagement. He was engaged a second time to a girl that had 17 years younger than me, who had been in a confirmation class that he had taught at Finkenwalde, and her name is Maria von Wedemeyer, and he writes a lot of letters to her from prison, but they are not in this volume, Letters and Papers from Prison, because she refused to give those letters to Baitke. And there was a time when this book first came out, Letters and Papers in Prison, that everybody wondered, you know, didn't he like girls? He had this boyfriend, but didn't he like girls at all? And people didn't know very much, you know, about those details. He was engaged to this girl, and while he was in prison, and he wrote her a good many letters, and about a year and a half ago, she gave those letters to Harvard University. She was in Texas for a while. She's now a computer programmer in Boston. And she gave those letters to Harvard University with the stipulation that they were to be open only to scholars and not to be published until after her death. And so, you know, we won't see those for a while, but she does write an article in the Union Seminary Quarterly Review of about a year and a half ago, a very short article giving some excerpts from letters to her. And he writes to her, for instance, about their coming marriage, and he says, our marriage shall be a yes to God's earth. Just one of the sentences. It's neat stuff, you know. And I don't wish her early demise, but I am panting a little bit to get those letters into print. Right. So he was engaged two times. No, I've not.
I'm going.
Yes, yes. I'm sure I could get access to them. I'll tell you about them. Yeah, well, I in the buttonhole. She says in this article that they are of such a highly personal nature that she just, you know, does not want them to be published. But Baitke thought that about the letters that he had written to him, too. I mean, he just got these letters from his friend and stuffed them in his pockets and in an old dresser drawer. He never had any idea at all that anybody would be interested in them. And it was only after a Bonhoeffer interest began to develop and they started to take every little grocery list, you know, and collect it, and he published them, and it was a big boom. Let me say a little bit about the rise of Hitler, because that happened just during this time. And while he was in his first years of teaching, Hitler was coming into power. And there are some significant dates. 1933, January 30th, Hitler became Chancellor of the Third Reich. Now, it's important, I think, to know that Hitler, the Nazi Party, never received more than 43.9% of the vote. We talk a lot in this country about the two-party system and the terrible things about it. There are all kinds of terrible things about it. Possibility of a third party. There are lots of countries, of course, France and Germany, in Europe preeminently, which are multi-party systems, Italy. And you never get, in those kinds of systems, a majority vote for anybody. So what you do is to make a coalition with various parties that get enough votes to get together and run the country. Well, Hindenburg was president of Germany, and the Nazis got 43.9% of the vote, and Hindenburg's party couldn't run the country. Obviously, the Nazis couldn't run the country, so they made a coalition government. Hindenburg was president. Hitler became chancellor. He became chancellor on January 30th, 1933. On February 1st, 30 days after September, April, June, and November, 2 days after Hitler became chancellor, Bonhoeffer went on Berlin radio. Some of you may have seen the little book, I Knew Dietrich Bonhoeffer, which is a series of little sketches by friends, edited by Wolf-Dieter Zimmermann, who is now working in Berlin for Berlin Radio, and he worked then for Berlin Radio. And Zimmermann got Bonhoeffer on Berlin Radio February 1st, 33. And he gave a speech on the radio entitled The Concept of the Leader. And he said, we Germans have always respected leadership. We have always had a high commitment to obedience, and that's a good thing. But here's a guy, Adolf, who this is 2 days after he came to power, who is not calling for obedience to the government or to the office, but who is calling for allegiance to his person. that is a tremendously dangerous switch from office to person. Führer means the leader, right? And Hitler says, you obey me, not I'm important because I'm me, not because I'm serving this particular office. Well, the Nazis cut off that radio speech when he was about two-thirds through, and in a certain sense, I suppose you could say, he was a marked man from the second day that Hitler was in office. He had that mimeograph and sent it out to his friends in order to show them what he wanted to say, and later he was given an opportunity to give that address in full at the Technical University. So that was February 1st. February 27th, less than 1 month after Hitler came to power, the Nazis arranged to burn the Reichstag, the main government building in Berlin, and Hitler came into power on an anti-communist ticket. That's another thing that's important to remember. His big thing was that he was going to save Germany from the Bolsheviks. He's going to save Germany from those massive hordes from the east, save them from the communists. Less than a month after he comes into power, the Nazis burn the Reichstag behind a police cordon and blame it on the communists. And they picked out a guy, his name was von der Lubbe, who was a mentally deficient character who happened also to be a communist. And he said, the communists burned the Reichstag. February 28th, that is the day after the burning of the Reichstag, the Nazis passed the Ordinance for the Protection of the People and the State. The Ordinances for the Protection of the People and the State from those 30 communists who burned the Reichstag, because the Nazis have burned it, right? And the ordinances for the protection of the people in the state were the removal of all personal rights. I saw that, the actual thing in there yesterday, and it's very interesting to me to read that, and I don't know if I can find that in a few seconds or not. What those things say. I guess I can't. What it meant was, for instance, investigative arrest, let's say, Untersuchungsgefängnis. You can, what it said is that you don't have to have a case against a guy. You don't have to have search warrants. You go into anybody's house without knocking on the door, and you pick him up by the nape of the neck, and you say, we are bringing you to prison for purposes of investigation. You don't have to charge him with anything. You just bring him to prison, and you leave him there until he rots, see, because you can delay forever if you want bringing his case up in court. The right of free assembly was obliterated. The right of the freedom of the press, censorship. This one of the fascinating things about the Bonhoeffer story is that it is so contemporary that it hurts very much.